You're listening to WEAA-FM, celebrating the 88 days of summer. Details at weaa.org. Support for WEAA is provided by KIDDA. So welcome back. I'm Kimberly Moffitt, sitting in today for Mark Steiner. For this Friday's news roundup, we have some great guests joining us to wrestle with what's happening both locally and nationally. I have in the studio with me Professor E.R. Shipp, journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism at Morgan State University and a former Pulitzer Prize winner. Thank you for joining us, Professor Shipp.
Thank you.
We also have on the phone Dr. Avis Jones-DeWeaver, who is president and CEO of Insight Unlimited. She is also the host of Focus Point with Avis Jones-DeWeaver on National Public Radio. Dr. Jones-DeWeaver, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So we start our Friday news roundup with a brief conversation about MSA results. Those scores were released for the state earlier this week. And one of the points that we learned from the state is that they released a breakdown of scores by race and economic background for us. And what those results showed is that everyone, no matter what color, had the same declines and increases on that standardized test. Each group's results mirrored those of the whole state, but there still seems to be achievement gaps that exist according to based on race. We also know that educational leaders, in particular the State Teachers Union and the School Superintendents Association, have asked for us to have a moratorium on testing because of those MSA scores. Calls for suspending the test follow the state's release of those most recent test scores, which dropped significantly for the first time in a decade. State officials have blamed the poor showing on rapid changes to the curriculum, specifically referred to as the Common Core. Professor Shipp, could you offer a perspective in terms of what we know about these MSA scores?
I guess it's not surprising that the scores are not what we want them to be. And that there's been a decline. But what's startling, I think, is that with all the resources we continue to put into our public education system, the results are not improving. Children are still being left behind, no matter what that law calls itself.
And what do you think that is?
I'm not sure whether the test is measuring what the children are learning well, and so that issue is for some others to talk about the validity of the test. But it seems to me, the test aside, if our students aren't reading and can't do basic math, something is wrong with how we are teaching them and what we are doing to reinforce what they are getting in the classroom. So I think we're looking at two things. Something has to change in the classroom, but we need to look at what we can do beyond that. What can we do to help them? What can we do to help with the homework?
We parents, community.
I'm speaking more as a community person. Mm-hmm. I don't have any children, but I am concerned. I see the results of this when students come to Morgan State University after they've come from this school system and other public school systems around the country. I look at one of these statistics, for example, that shows that by the time black kids reach eighth grade, 31% fewer of them are passing the state tests compared to whites. That's just in math. And you think as they go from year to year, they're falling further behind. We see that when they get to college.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's why I say we, the community at large, needs to find ways to get involved. At a church I'm attending, for example, there's now going to be a big push at the beginning of the school year for us to get involved with an after-school program, to be available, to help with the homework, to be mentors. And I think we need to do more of that.
And I think I would concur with you in terms of the role the community does need to play in assisting our educational system. Dr. Jones-Weaver, if you could chime in terms of your perspective, even though I know you are situated in D.C., these are not unfamiliar conversations in D.C. any more than in Maryland.
It's not. And actually, my background, many years ago, I had the pleasure of working for the current mayor of Baltimore, her dad, Delegate
okay.
Rawlings, who was extremely concerned and worked diligently to help improve the education system in Baltimore. And so I am quite familiar with Baltimore education issues. And I think that he would be very disturbed, frankly, by these latest numbers. But I agree. Once you have a curriculum shift, there is going to be somewhat of a disjuncture between that and the evaluation mechanism that had been in place previously. So that then raises the question, what really needs to be the purpose of evaluation and the goals of an education system? I know one of the challenges that we face in, I actually live in Virginia, though I work in D.C., I live in Virginia, and one of my critiques of our system here in terms of our testing mechanism is that, and I think that Virginia is not alone in this, many states face this conundrum, where teachers are so driven and incentivized, and in fact, I would argue threatened in not so subtle ways, to teach to a specific evaluation method, to teach to a test, that one wonders, in what ways are our children really receiving a broad and deep and substantial education? Right. Are they actually given the opportunity to learn how to think creatively, how to be critical thinkers, how to really be able to analyze a situation instead of rote memorization for everything? I think that we need to take a step back, not just in Maryland, not just in the district, not just in Virginia, but in this nation to say, maybe we need to look at how we do education in this country and really think of ways that we can invest in it better so that there are less disparities, but also so that we invest in things that are ballyworks for the future, making sure that children receive the foundation in those basic skills that, of course, every child needs. But in addition to that, so that children have specific emphasis in those particular areas that we know are critical for the world economy that ultimately they will have to compete in.
Right. And I think for those of us that are in college classrooms, we would wholeheartedly concur that there seems to be a major disconnect between what we are teaching in K through 12 and what we value in K through 12 versus what is necessary to be successful in the college classroom.
Exactly. Because in college, you're just not checking boxes. you have to really be able to critique and understand and analyze an issue. And are we really doing our children a disservice when we're not providing them those skills from day one? I really wonder about our long-term abilities to prepare our young people, not just for college, but also competing with people halfway around the world, which they will have to do not only in college, but once they graduate.
Absolutely. We want you to join us in this conversation and share your thoughts. Reach us at 410-319-8888. You can email us at steinershow@gmail.com or tweet us at Mark Steiner. If we can, I also think it's really interesting in terms of what the shift has been with the unions taking a stance on this and what their primary concerns are about the tests. And I wonder if either of our guests would like to comment on why they are taking such a hard stance on the MSAs not having much value or being very useful to us because of this shift to the Common Core. Because in terms of all the information we know about the Common Core, it's only going to be more difficult than what the MSA is. So what does that then say in terms of this hard and fast stance that the unions are taking on the MSA?
Well, I can just say in general, one hopes that the union stance is for the good of the students. Unfortunately, sometimes it's just to protect the jobs of the teachers. So here we need to sort out what the objectives of the unions is. The test does need to be looked at to see if indeed it is measuring achievement and measuring in a way that students can be taught what they need to know in life beyond the test. But that's a conversation that does need to be held. So if the union's action in seeking to have a moratorium brings this discussion to the fore, then fine. If it's just another ploy to protect teachers who are not doing their jobs, then we have another issue.
Right.
Yeah, and I will say that those questions are always raised. I guess I will admit that I'm a bit biased because I'm the daughter of a teacher. So I sort of put that out there. But I would empathize with the fact that individuals are under high stakes testing. Teachers are judged based on the product that happens at the end of the year, whether or not their students perform on those tests, which one could argue is a very fair, one could argue on one side that that's a fair assessment in terms of how one can determine how effective a particular teacher is. But on the other hand, you know, are we really looking at the disparities that teachers have in different classrooms? You know, what are the students starting out with? What other supports do the students receive before and after that sort of classroom instruction? And once again, even if you have a wonderful teacher and who does have the impact of having children score well on those tests, at the end of the day, is that teacher constrained so much in the classroom that they really can't meet their full potential because they have to focus so much on what those tests are focused on rather than providing a more holistic educational background and foundation for their children? I know teachers who feel very constrained by standardized testing, who are brilliant teachers, but have to spend so much time on practice tests, on reviews, on a curriculum that, at least in Virginia, is very, very much in line with the tests that the children have to take at the end of the year, that they leave so much, very much needed information, in my mind, off the table because they, quite frankly, just don't have time to get to it because so much of their time is monopolized by making sure those kids can check the right boxes at the end of the school year.
Right.
Really not what real teachers are passionate about. They want their children to learn.
Absolutely. We have Sharon and Susan on the line who'd like to join us in this conversation. Please, Sharon, your comment.
Well, thank you for taking my comment. And I've been in education for over 30 years. I'm also the daughter of a teacher. And what I'd like to raise is my concern about the growing numbers of alternative tracks to certification for teachers. You know, we've had a tremendous increase in non-teacher, hello?
Yes, we're with you.
In non-teacher or non-traditionally trained teachers. And I would really like someone to study the impact of all these alternative routes to teacher certification. A friend of mine that's an administrator made a comment that would we go to a dentist that got his or her training over the summer or over the weekends. And we're seeing fewer and fewer teachers who have been trained traditionally, who may be, as a result of their greater training, able to make accommodations, teach for the test as well as teach for content. And I think that has not been examined. One of the things that happened with this study that the Bush administration came out with, A Nation at Risk, was that so many significant changes were made to American education, and we're still seeing the results and some of the damage of that stuff.
Yes, and I concur with your thoughts and think that it's a perfect segue to also hearing some of the comments that Susan wanted to add to our conversation. So thank you, Sharon.
Hello?
Susan, yes, you're on the air.
Hi, Hi, thank you for having me, and I'm really welcome to this conversation. So I'm the director of the Baltimore Student Attendance Campaign, and while I do recognize that the shift in teaching to align with the new Common Core standards versus what the MSA test may be part of why the students aren't being successful in the test, I also want to argue that there's a not well understood crisis in our country, in our city, in our state, around the issue of chronic absenteeism. And we have in our country 7.5 million children who miss 20 or more days of school a year. And in certain parts in urban areas, it's as many as one out of four kids. And what we know from the research is that when a student misses 20 or more days of school, which is the Maryland definition, that they are not likely to read on grade level. They're more likely to be retained. They're more likely to be identified for special education services and far, far, far less likely to graduate from high school. And we have so many kids that miss 20 or more days of school that they're putting themselves at risk academically. And what also happens when you have a school that has many, many children that fall into this category, that the churn in the classroom of kids coming and going actually affects teaching and learning for the entire classroom, as the teacher's constantly having to reteach older material and catch kids up who have missed a lot of school. And so this is an area of concern that I think needs way more attention. And it is also an area where, as you were talking about earlier, where the community can really get involved and help to support families and schools around identifying why the students are missing school and helping them to get there every day.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your feedback, Susan. So if we can, for my guests, I'm going to shift just a bit and move to another conversation, because I think this is one that we could certainly continue for a while and will be ongoing as we are shifting to the new Common Core standards in our public school system. But one of the other news items of this week is a stance that Attorney General Eric Holder took, in which he has said to us that the Justice Department is preparing to take fresh legal action in a string of voting rights cases across the nation. And in fact, he has gone so far as to say that this is a decision to challenge state officials about some of the changes that have been made in voting rights laws, which is a result of the recent Supreme Court decision regarding the Voting Rights Act and the fact that history of discrimination is not any longer a factor, and so we don't need to do some of the redistricting or have the same types of districting we had in previous decades. This is, of course, on the heels of the Texas redistricting case, but we also know that there is an even more contemporary example to look to in North Carolina with their voting ID bill. So, Professor Shipp, if you would like to chime in on that.
Well, I think what the Attorney General is doing is quite bold. The Supreme Court just a month ago pretty much gutted a key portion of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which had allowed the federal government to preempt some of the things that the states and some localities were up to in their voting process. Under this particular section of the law, these targeted states and localities, including New York, parts of New York City, for example, had to get pre-clearance, had to get approval of any changes they wanted to make in where people voted, what hours they voted, what the districts would look like. All of those kinds of things had to be approved. The Supreme Court said that it was unfair, essentially, to pick on nine states and these various localities because there was no real proof that they were violating the rights of people the way they were doing back in 1965. And before. The Chief Justice said that we have come a long way since 1965, so these states shouldn't be burdened by having the federal government approve everything they want to do. Well, the first thing Texas did after the decision in the Shelby case last month was to announce that it was going to go back to trying to enforce its new voter ID rules. And that's what Holder is now going after. So what he's going to do is to set an example, he hopes, that even though they can't use the particular section that was gutted by the Shelby decision last month, they can use another section of that law. And that will allow them to go after those states where they have proof that these states are violating the rights of people. And the key thing is that they want to do this before the elections, because you still have the right after an election to challenge the results. But then you've gone through the election.
Absolutely.
People have been turned away from polls. Who knows how many votes were cast improperly? And it will take years to overdo an election. So the key thing is for Holder and the federal government in general to find an effective way to preempt these things that they're doing in Texas and that North Carolina is now trying to do.
But we're now hearing, though, that once again, this is the bullying of state government by the federal government.
That's the argument
absolutely.
That North Carolina and Texas and others will make.
Absolutely.
And they go back to this kind of states' rights thing. The federal government can't come in and tell us how to do our business. There is a role for the federal government. It's called the United States Constitution. And the 15th Amendment in particular gave blacks the right to vote.
So Mother Jones published an article earlier this week to refer to the recent decision by North Carolina's state legislature that it referred to that bill as the nation's worst. And they lay out for us specifically things that have been changed in the bill regarding voting rights. Just to read a few of them, the revised bill prohibits same-day registration. It ends pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, eliminates 1 week of early voting, also prevents counties from extending voting hours due to long lines or any other extraordinary circumstances, scratches college IDs and other forms of identification from the very short list of acceptable state-issued photo IDs, as well as now requiring that you have a government-issued ID in order to vote. Based on state Board of Election data, we also know that 35% of the state's registered black voters, which, of course, are overwhelmingly who overwhelmingly vote Democrat, do not have a state-issued ID. And we also know that 55% of North Carolina Democrats do not have a state-issued ID in comparison to only 21% of Republicans with that same concern. Dr. Jones DeWeaver, you'd like to chime in for us.
Yes, and Mother Jones is absolutely right. This is clearly one of the worst in the nation. And one of the reasons behind the Moral Monday protests, which continue in North Carolina, and in fact are growing.
Yes.
This is a clear example of very race-specific and party-specific voter gerrymandering, if that's a term I'm just creating right now.
We'll let you do that.
Because clearly what's happening here, you have now for the first time in decades in North Carolina a Republican governor as well as Republicans in charge.
Absolutely.
Of both the House and the Senate, and they have just taken the baton and running amok with it. And this is just one of various examples of legislation that they are attempting to push through, which would help to sort of tilt the pool in their favor in future elections. Let's be very clear about what's going on here, though. Not only in North Carolina, but in Texas and in other states throughout the country, as it relates to a lot of these voter ID, a lot of these voter ID laws and other very ingenuous acts. What's happening here is that we as a nation are undergoing a demographic shift. We are becoming a nation who will, in the very near future, frankly, in our lifetimes, in most of our lifetimes who are listening here, will become a majority people of color nation. And this, what we are witnessing right now, are the last very desperate flails of white supremacy in America. There is broad understanding that if you are becoming now a numerical minority, one of the ways in which you can retain power then is to change the rules of the game so that those who are gaining in their representation will be less likely to actuate their power in the voting booth. And that's exactly what's going on right now. That's really the impetus, I would argue, behind what's happened in North Carolina, behind what's happening in Texas, behind what's happening in Alabama, things that happen really quick right after this Supreme Court decision.
But you know what? It may make it an easier case to make for Holder when he sees these very blatant things that are happening. And guess what? They're happening in the very states that were under scrutiny because of the Voting Rights Act in the first place.
Right.
So
exactly.
Those same states are coming up with what they think are creative ways to get around. Back in 65, we were fighting against poll taxes that were required to be paid before you can vote, or you had to be able to give some kind of take some kind of literacy test where you had to recite passages from the U.S. Constitution and such things. Well, those are gone, and yes, that's the past, but these are the new versions
right.
of that.
And so if I can ask Professor Shipp to hold that thought, folks, we have to take a very short break at this time, but if you have thoughts that you'd like to share, you can call us at 410-319-8888 or write us at steinershow@gmail.com. Please don't go away. We'll be right back to continue this conversation. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, please contact www.mequ.com. Welcome back. I am Kimberly Moffitt, sitting in today for Mark Steiner. We're joined this morning again by Professor E.R. Shipp, journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism at Morgan State University, as well as Dr. Avis Jones DeWeaver, president and CEO of Insight Unlimited and host of Focus Point with Avis Jones DeWeaver on National Public Radio. Want to continue our conversation about the voting rights laws and what we see happening in Texas as well as North Carolina and the Department of Justice's response to that. And so, Professor Shipp, you were finishing up a point that we wanted to continue after the break.
Well, I was just saying that some of the very blatant things that were being done in the 1960s and that the Voting Rights Act was designed to address have gone away. And that's a good thing. But now we're seeing these states coming back with new and improved modern-day versions of those obstacles to voting. And what's crazy is that we are in the 21st century. Rather than these cumbersome things that are being put into place, voting should be so much easier.
Absolutely.
You should be able to email your vote or something. I mean, why are we talking about not letting people vote after they stood online for hours and the voting machine breaks and too bad you can't vote that day? Why are we saying you can't vote on weekends and after work? Why can't you vote by mail? Why can't 16 and 17-year-olds have easy registration so that becoming a voter becomes part of their initiation into adulthood while they're still in high school? Why?
Any different than like what we used to do at Selective Service, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how simple it was to make sure you had registered. So,
but now the wrong color of people are voting, and that's what these laws are all about.
Dr. Jones Weaver.
Yes. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, what we're talking about is it's not really rocket science. Clearly. If the motivation here was to really perform in a democracy, if the motivation really was to create a situation where we would empower the people, where we would have an opportunity where one man, one vote was a real concept, then all of those things that the professor mentioned would, of course, be implemented, no questions asked. That's not the motivation here. The motivation here is to shrink the voting pool and to almost sort of drown it in a pool, as was famously stated about the role of government. But the idea here is to shrink it to a specific subset of the population, which is afraid of losing power. You know, not just looking at what happened in North Carolina. If you look at, once again, what's going on in Texas, if you really sort of tear back the skin of what they are proposing down there, this particular law that they have reintroduced that was, in fact, struck down by the court before the Supreme Court case, the lower courts, before the Supreme Court case was found, what was very interesting about that particular law, you had things in that law like you can't use your student ID to be able to vote, but if you have a concealed weapons permit, you can use that to vote. I mean, that's a very clear example of targeting specific populations, because in Texas you are more likely to have a concealed weapons permit if you are white than if you are a person of color. And so clearly that was discriminatory. It was rightfully struck down. But once the Supreme Court has now come out with its decision claiming that discrimination was something that happened in the 60s and prior to the 60s, totally disregarding all the shenanigans that happened in the last presidential election, totally disregarding all of the evidence that was put in place when the Voting Rights Act was last reauthorized, clearly disregarding all of that. Basically what it did was pave the way for this type of micromanaging of the voting population that we are once again seeing happening in Texas, in North Carolina, in states across the nation. So I commend Eric Holder for having the courage to stand up to that and say, I'm not going to sit back and wait for Congress to get its act together, because clearly it has made the decision that with this president in office, its most important value is to basically get as little done as possible. Instead, I am going to move forward and use what remains available to me under what hasn't been struck down under the Voting Rights Act to go after what is clearly discriminatory actions on behalf of these states.
Yes, let me remind you that if you'd like to join us in this conversation and share your thoughts, please do so at 410-319-8888. And you can also email us at steinershow@gmail.com or tweet us at Mark Steiner. I'd like to ask our guests, do we think some of these moves or tactics that are being made by states, could this be a part of or a result of what many of us refer to as the Obama effect, that the presence of President Obama, Barack Obama, in office, creating this visual shift for many of what is happening in the country as in terms of becoming more a country of people of color, could this also be a direct result of why we see so much happening in several of these states?
I'm not sure if it's specific to Obama, because it seems to me that Republicans in power in these states are trying to hold on to power. So it may not be necessarily related to the fact that we have a black president, we have a Democrat president, and we have Democrats that they're trying to defeat. But speaking of the Obama effect, Obama has had many effects. He may have had that effect of kind of galvanizing the anti-black part of our country that votes. But I think he may have had an effect of lulling blacks into a sleep that we cannot afford. I don't understand why all of those black voters in North Carolina allowed their government to be taken over so that you have a governor and a state house that is led by Republicans who don't have their interests.
So it shows us that the effect can go both ways.
It can go many ways, yes, and it seems to be doing that.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm not sure that I agree. I do believe that this is an example of the Obama effect. And, I say that because, You know, here we have a president who won election largely on the voting power of black and brown people. I mean, let's just get it straight here. The reason why we have a president who looks like Obama in the White House today is because he carried by large majorities people of color in this nation and young people. The majority of white people did not vote for President Obama, even when you talk about white women, okay? The majority of white women even did not vote for Obama, either in 2008 or in the most recent election. He's there because people of color greatly expanded in terms of our representation in the electoral pool, and we came out at the polls. In fact, in the last presidential election, African Americans outvoted every other demographic group in this country, period, voted at higher levels even than whites. And, you know, I would argue that what happened in North Carolina, it was a very close election. But still, African Americans are not the majority of people in North Carolina. And despite their best efforts, unfortunately, this state has swung backwards. Now, what we see now there is great activism that's going on in North Carolina, led by black activists in terms of these protests post-election. I certainly hope, my greatest concern, though, is what's going to happen in the next election. What typically happens in off-year elections when a presidential candidate is not on the ballot is that you have a very different electorate that comes to the polls than you do during during presidential elections. And what I mean by that is it's a much smaller electorate and it's a much whiter electorate.
But that we know that's going to be the case. So this is a time for better voter education. So as people are carrying out these voter registration drives, which I hope groups like the NAACP, National Action Network, Urban League, et cetera, are conducting, they need to do voter education. And they also need to make sure people get proper identification.
I have Alan on the line. Alan, you'd like to comment, please.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to comment. It seems more than a strange coincidence that voting rights suppression, and it doesn't matter whether you believe elections are the solution or not, but people have the right to make that choice and to get involved in elections. But it's also very coincidental, more than coincidental, that Texas has the most severe anti-choice laws. So that what happens is not only are they suppressing women's right to choose, but they're also suppressing the people's right to choose also, so that you have this shotgun effect of going at people who want to vote for change, no matter what you think about that process, and also women who want to control their own bodies. And you have this strange conglomerate, like, for example, the Dorothy Day Catholic worker in Washington, D.C., the Seamless Garment Network, lining up with people like Rick Perry to say that abortion is murder, and lining up with people that wouldn't give them the time of day ordinarily, it's just a very sad thing. And when you hear about, for example, certain black anti-abortion activists saying that there are more abortion clinics in black communities, when in fact in the South, the Black Belt, which is also the Bible Belt, which is also the lynching belt, you find women's right to choose being thoroughly decimated.
And Alan is making a key point here, because the same types of laws in terms of voter suppression and women's rights are, again, also being dealt with in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. There's a lot being done. I think Dr. Jones DeWeaver mentioned earlier about the Moral Monday protests that are being done in that state to address, again, the voter rights laws, but also the anti-abortion bills that are being pushed through that very Republican House as well as to the Republican governor. If I can shift a bit and talk about another really interesting topic that happened this week, and this one focuses on the NYPD chief Ray Kelly in an op-ed piece that he wrote in the Wall Street Journal earlier this week, in which he has been in reference to NYPD's stop and frisk policy, which, of course, almost exclusively encompasses minorities and has also been said to include the practice of spying on Muslims. He makes a point in his op-ed piece that there have been the specific number of 7,383 fewer murders during Mayor Bloomberg's 11-year tenure during than the 11 years prior to. And he cites that as evidence for what the NYPD has done, in particular with its stop and frisk policy. He has also said that the accusation of racial profiling is a disingenuous charge at best. And he thought that in 2003, when the NYPD recognized that 96% of individuals who were shot were Black and Hispanic, he said what we did at that moment was concentrated our officers on those troubled minority neighborhoods. So he makes the case that although it is seen as racial profiling, in fact, what it did was to protect and serve the very people who were victims. So I'd like to ask Professor Shipp to join us on this conversation and her reaction to what Ray Kelly had to say.
Well, I think it is possible to separate, in theory, the stop and frisk policy and racial profiling. More often than not, I think the officers on the street don't make a distinction. So that's the problem. They stop everybody, Black and Latino,
right.
As opposed to stopping and frisking in particular areas at particular times of the day where crime has been the problem. So I think Kelly is making a valid point and one that is fairly persuasive. When you are the victim of crime, you want the police to do whatever it takes to protect you. He is not so persuasive, though, if you happen to be the person who is going about your business doing nothing wrong and have to suffer the indignity
of
being
frisk.
Stopped and not just, you know, stopped politely, but treated like a criminal.
Right.
And, you know, being forced out of your vehicle and then searched. And then they say, oh, never mind. Sorry. Hope you have a nice day. So I think on paper, it's a good policy. It seems to be effective. I think the question becomes, how do you put it into practice, this stop and frisk, without it turning into an opportunity for gung-ho officers on the street to target Black males, Black and Latino males?
So Chief Kelly also is quoted as saying, we have to face the reality that New York's minority communities experience a disproportionate share of violent crime. To ignore that fact, as our critics would have us to do, would be a form of discrimination in itself. Dr. Jones Weaver, how do you respond to that?
Overall, I think that his piece shows that he may need to be diagnosed with schizophrenia. On the one hand, he says that, of course, racial profiling or stop and frisk, which really is implemented in that state, let's be very in that city, very real, is racial profiling. If you're only stopping Blacks and Latinos, clearly that's racial profiling going on there. Clearly it's effective. Look at the numbers. But then at the same time, he says, but we don't profile racially. I mean, you're contradicting yourself. I also believe that he needs a basic 101 primer lesson in causation versus causality, because I could also argue that over the last decade, we've seen huge drops, and I would be correct, in the murder rate in states like Boston, in cities like Boston. We've seen it drop. Even in the District of Columbia, we've seen drops in several cities around this nation that don't implement stop and frisk policies. So to assume that because you also see a drop in murder rates in New York City, to say that the only motivating factor for that or that the cause of that is his stop and frisk policy is, to me, a very, very deceiving use of the data. I would also suggest that it's more than just an inconvenience to be stopped. Oftentimes, in this very aggressive use of infringing upon people's liberty, which is supposed to be part of what we are constitutionally guaranteed to be able to have some liberty, in the process of that, they are able to get people with summons with sort of very, very minor infractions. And if an individual does not show up in trial for those summons or doesn't pay the fine, then all of a sudden they have a warrant. Then they begin to have a record. You know, then they have to pay larger fines. So this subset of the community is being disproportionately impacted by these very, very punitive measures. And there are different ways to create a situation that improves a crime scenario, like actually, you know, not only increasing the presence of police in the community, but building good relationships with the community, rather than seeing everyone in that community as a potential suspect. The thought that he is even being considered as the next Secretary of Homeland Security is frightening to me. I do not want a man like this in the position that he has in New York City, and I definitely wouldn't want him in charge of anything in the federal government.
So I've had Jack holding the line for a few minutes and like to hear your thought before we wrap up our show. Jack, please.
Yes, thank you very much. I want to make the point that conservatism can be indexed as racialist. If one surveys the correspondence between conservative actions and thoughts, one sees a high correlation, you see. So mathematically, in today's environment, conservatism is proportional statistically to racism. The other situation is when one talks about the old voting codes of the South, those things where you had to know the number of windows in the UN building, that sort of thing. Well, we don't have those now, but that very animus has been redistributed. So it doesn't go away. It's simply redistributed. And the final thing is, what in the world is our strategy for 2016 for some sort of continuity along the lines of the kinds of things that we need to do to progress politically? Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for your call. And Jack raises some valid points that I think Professor Shipp was also alluding to in terms of what we need to be doing now in preparation for 2016. And hopefully we'll see some of that come to fruition. Going back to the conversation about Chief Kelly and this racial profiling piece, I think it's really interesting in terms of the timing of this op-ed piece coming on the heels of the Zimmerman verdict and what it suggests about how we see, again, in terms of much of what I think about the representations of the black body, how we see that body as criminal and the result of our willingness to always target that particular body to stop and frisk. And as a result of that, how many people who possibly are committing crimes are we missing when we are so focused and targeted on that particular population?
Sure, because you won't see those people in suits and ties who are committing the big crimes, running banks, running securities companies, running real estate firms. You don't necessarily see them as criminal. Before we wrap up, I wanted to make a point about something that the name Emmett Till has come up a lot as we think about Trayvon Martin in a historical context. Yesterday would have been his 72nd birthday. Mm. It's kind of hard to imagine that. And then when you think about at some point in time, we'll be saying Trayvon Martin would have been 72. The point is they were young black youth who were cut down because of racism. In the Till case, by the way, the last witness in that case who testified against the two white men who ultimately were acquitted, that man, Willie Lewis, died a few days ago. And we should remember him for the courage it took to stand up and say that these are the men I saw carrying Emmett Till.
Yeah, because he suffered a number of consequences as a result of
he was forced to leave Mississippi and to hide, in essence, in Chicago. He suffered a mental breakdown because of the stress, but he was able eventually to pull his life together and only recently began talking about his experiences in Mississippi. So let's remember Willie Lewis as we remember Emmett Till.
Absolutely. Dr. Jones DeWeaver, we are wrapping up and would love to hear any final thoughts from you.
Yeah, just sort of piggybacking off of that, it is a tragedy that we see our young men, so many people in this nation see our young men as innately a threat. I'm the mother of a 17-year-old black boy who has also been stopped in his father's neighborhood, this time by a policeman and not by a private citizen, for the crime of, quote-unquote, looking suspicious, even though he's not a criminal, even though he had every right to be there. And it is hard for me to explain to him now, following this verdict, what exactly is he to do when he could possibly be stopped by a private citizen with no authority for the crime of, quote-unquote, looking suspicious. And by the way, he wasn't wearing a hoodie, so I'm tired of that whole discussion. So the reality is that we need to, as a nation, stand up and say, no more. These are our children. Their lives have value.
Children.
They have worth.
Children, absolutely. And it's unfortunate that in a nation such as ours that we are even having to have these talks with our young men to protect themselves and ensure that they come home to us every night. That's all the time we have for today. I would like to thank both of our guests, Professor E.R. Shipp, journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism at Morgan State University, as well as Dr. Avis Jones DeWeaver, president and CEO of Insight Unlimited, and host of Focus Point with Avis Jones DeWeaver on National Public Radio. To learn more about our guests and their work, please visit steinershow.org. Again, I'm Kimberly Moffitt, sitting in this morning for Mark Steiner. We have to take another short break, but please don't go anywhere. When we come back, we look at a conversation that took place here on the Mark Steiner Show between educators and activists in Chicago and Baltimore about the future of education. Stay tuned.